The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme...
What Cumannamon did demanded secrecy.
It took the Crown forces a while to cop on to just how much women were doing under their noses.
We continue our series on the Irish War of Independence, and tonight our focus is on the women of the revolution.
The role of women, you know, is absolutely critical, because if that's not happening, then the guerrilla campaign breaks down.
We'll hear about the vital role they played in the conflict and how Cumannamon served as the eyes and ears of the Republican campaign.
When these women are actually dealing with arms and ammunition in the home, they're breaking down the rifles, they're getting them ready for the next event or ambush.
I think women, they had a habit of downplaying and underestimating their own involvement and their own importance.
We'll also discuss the physical and mental trauma of the war and the gendered violence perpetrated by both the IRA and the Crown Forces. We begin this evening with Cumannamon, the Irish Republican Women's Organisation formed in 1914 that was in many ways the backbone of the revolution. Let's hear first from the RTE radio archives and the voice of Sheila Humphreys recalling the devotion of these women to their cause.
I joined Ranelagh branch of Cumannamon, and I was very, very, very happy in Cumannamon after that. Of course, everybody was, because this, what they call now solidarity, was something extraordinary. You had a completely new idea of life. It was what you could do for Cumannamon and what you could do for Ireland, and nothing else mattered. Nothing else. The one priority was to get our freedom.
And that was the voice there of Sheila Humphreys of Cumannamon. I'll be joined throughout this programme by four guests. Mary Coleman is in our Belfast studio. She's senior lecturer in history at Queen's University in Belfast. Mary McAuliffe is an historian with University College Dublin. Tomás McNamara is an oral historian and author. And Aelva Rogers is an historian and PhD candidate at Maynooth University. You're all very welcome indeed. Mary, in our Belfast studio, talk to us first of all a bit about some of the tasks undertaken by Cumannamon women as the guerrilla campaign progressed and as prominent volunteers were forced to leave their homes and go on the run.
Well, I suppose the first thing you could talk about is what Cumannamon did not do. Although a military organisation, there was a gender division of labour in the Irish War of Independence, and the Cumannamon women were not in the actual front line. They weren't setting the roadside bombs or firing on the enemy in ambushes, but they did everything up to that point. Many of those ambushes could not have been carried out without the preparatory military work done by women. For example, women often transported arms and ammunition to the site of these ambushes. They could do that because they weren't going to come under suspicion to the same extent. It took the Crown forces a while to cop on to just how much women were doing under their noses. So they were involved in military activities to that level. They were also involved in acquiring arms and ammunition in the first place. The local units, much of the arms and ammunition were supplied by GHQ in Dublin, so it was not uncommon for the job of transporting hand grenades or other material for the manufacture of munitions from Dublin to the regions for women, Cumannamon women, to be given those jobs, again, because they were less conspicuous. So they had military jobs, they also had intelligence work, which again very much exploited their gender and the fact that they didn't come under suspicion. And of course they did a lot of, I suppose, caring for volunteers on the run, bringing them supplies, and of course rendering first aid when volunteers were injured during ambushes.
And running safe houses, they took huge risks in accommodating volunteers who were on the run, didn't they? Many of them did.
Oh yes, very much so. And in some cases they were family members, in other cases they weren't. And you see the effects of that. If they were caught, very often they themselves could be subjected to physical assaults, or their property could be burned and destroyed by the Crown forces as a reprisal for having done that.
Now, you talked about their role in intelligence. Obviously, one of those was in transporting documents and dispatches. But another one, which is often not cited, would have been their work as postmistresses, people who were working in the post office, because post offices were vital in the intelligence war, weren't they?
Oh, very much so. Postmistresses, if you go through that wonderful collection of military service pensions collection, it's notable how many of the women who were awarded pensions for intelligence work worked in post office work. I think it was Siobhan Langford in Mallow had been doing this from around the time of the Easter Rising. Her military service pension application is very detailed on that, because of course telegraphs and the post was the principal means of communication. So if British headquarters in Dublin wanted to correspond with the army or the crown forces in the regions, most of those communications went through the post offices, through telegrams. Now often they were in cipher, but once Collins's people could break those ciphers, the local IRA intelligence officers at brigade level would give the broken cipher to the Cumann na mBan women. They could decipher it, or they could just take the communication in cipher, get another Cumann na mBan woman to transport it and give it to the IRA brigade intelligence officer, who then could decipher it himself. So they often kept one step ahead of the British, or at least one step very close behind them, to work out what they were doing.
Let's hear now another voice from the RTE radio archives. This short clip is of Mary O'Connor, a Cumann na mBan member, talking about the vital role of the organisation and some of the things they did during the war.
I don't think they could ever have managed without them. The men couldn't have. We were trained in first aid. We were trained how to break a rifle or a revolver and close it again, and how to keep them clean, how to mine them in for dumps. Places of security where they could be kept.
Mary, when you hear that, you're talking about moving and operating firearms and breaking them down, it reveals a more militant aspect about the organisation, doesn't it, by Cumann na mBan?
Yes, I think so. And I think we have to talk more also about how the front line isn't a specific place outside of the home, for example. I would argue that the front line comes into the home, and these women are actually dealing with arms and ammunition in the home. They're breaking down the rifles, they're cleaning them, they're getting them ready for the next event or ambush that they're going to be used in. For example, a woman in North Kerry, Maya Hearn, of the Coulard branch near Listowel, talks about bringing a revolver to several different ambushes. So she keeps this in her home, and when it's needed, she transports it to where it is needed, and she's cleaned it in between times.
And if the house is raided, she will take the consequences.
Oh, absolutely. And this is what happened. So the house would be raided several times, and women talk about their houses being raided several times a day or a week, and eventually they get burnt out. But interestingly, with the Cumann na mBan women, oftentimes they talk about how they continued their work after that. They saw that trauma of being made homeless in many cases as part of their contribution to the War of Independence. So they kept going after that, and they would set themselves up in a neighbour's house or a relation's house and continue minding arms dumps, transporting arms. And another thing they did, which was very important for militant activities, was scouting. So they would scout out an area around where an ambush might be planned, and they would keep an eye on the activities of the local RIC and the auxiliaries, especially if they were living close by. So women who had houses near barracks were very important for that intelligence work. And I think that intelligence work is underestimated. And it was not just the women in Cumann na mBan. Some women were not in Cumann na mBan and indeed asked either to leave Cumann na mBan or not to join, so their intelligence work wouldn't come under suspicion.
And the whole issue of intelligence then becomes problematic when it comes to applying for pensions and
exactly,
applying for medals, etc. Yeah. Et
Nobody can say what they did, because the code of silence is so important.
Indeed. Let's narrow it down a little bit and just look at one specific county. Elva, you're a native of County Louth, and you've written extensively about Irish nationalist women in Louth in the opening decades of the 20th century. So when did Cumann na mBan become active in Louth in particular?
Became active in November 1915, and it was really spearheaded by a woman in Dundalk. Her name was Angela Matthews. She became president of Dundalk Cumann na mBan. Her family ran the Dundalk Examiner newspaper in the town. It was a very anti-Parnellite, very pro-Sinn Féin newspaper. Her father was the editor. Angela had, she had her hand in a lot of different pies in terms of nationalist organisations in the town. So she was treasurer of the Gaelic League. She was involved in Sinn Féin. the Irish National Foresters. I really don't know how she had time to run her own stationery shop, to be honest.
And it appears that in County, in Dundalk in particular, I'm not sure about County Louth in general, that it was quite difficult to get into Cumann na mBan. They were very selective.
They were very selective. And I actually think that that comes from some of the women who were being drawn into Cumann na mBan were coming from the Ancient Order of Hibernians, which was naturally a very secretive organisation with oaths and regalia and secrets and things. So it was very difficult to get in. So what Angela Matthews did was, first of all, in November 1915, she handpicked a number of women who she thought might be sympathetic to come to her house. And then it wasn't until a few months later, in February 1916, that they advertised it in the newspapers. But the very selective process, you almost had to pass a series of tests. So you had to prove that your business or employment didn't bring you into contact with local RIC or armed forces. You had to prove that you were learning the Irish language, and also that you were buying goods of Irish manufacture. Also that your family background, that you had some connection to the Fenian tradition. So there was a lot of barriers that you had to cross.
Yeah, and one of those sounds, Mary, to me, utterly counterintuitive, that you should have no contact with the Crown Forces or with the RIC, because obviously if you have contact, that could prove to be very useful to Cumann na mBan and the IRA.
Well, absolutely, because I have come across some women who were actually cleaners in RIC barracks and who were very, very useful to the IRA in that they, number one, were providing intelligence work and giving details of the activities and when the men were leaving the barracks, at what times, etc. But also they were stealing arms and ammunition out of the barracks. And Amelia Wilmot in Listowel was so good for the local IRA that they wrote a letter to the RIC when she came under a bit of suspicion, saying that they would kill her for working with the RIC. So the RIC escorted her to work every day and home again, even though she was bringing out guns under her skirts. But again, it was a very dangerous line to tread. You know, where was the contact kind of flowing over then into maybe being considered an informer or being considered keeping company with the RIC and the auxiliaries? So it was a dangerous line, and sometimes perhaps Cumann na mBan would be a bit more strict. Obviously, in Louth, they would have been, yes.
Angela Matthews is obviously a key woman in Louth and in Dundalk, Ailva. But one woman with a particularly interesting story was somebody called Bridget Kelly. Tell me about her.
So Bridget Kelly was from an area in Louth called Grange Bellew. And Grange Bellew was just outside Dunlear. And she became involved in the movement through her two brothers, who were both in the IRA. And she joined Grange Bellew, Cumann na mBan. During the War of Independence, her house is raided multiple times by the Black and Tans. Sometimes the family would sleep out in the field to avoid the notice of the Black and Tans. During the War of Independence as well, there was a determined effort made to burn local RIC stations and Coast Guard stations. Bridget Kelly, she carried petrol to the sites of the burnings for the men. Grange Bellew as well, it's very close to the Belfast-Dublin train line. And in fact, the train line runs just outside the Kelly's house still today. But locals remember Bridget Kelly holding up trains with a gun, demanding that all the Belfast goods be thrown from the train, because, of course, the Belfast boycott is in full swing.
This is subsequent to the pogroms in Belfast, where there was a pretty well-organised countrywide boycott of goods from Belfast. Now, you've also been looking at activity in South Armagh. South Armagh, of course, is the homeland of the Aikens. And, I mean, obviously everybody's heard of Frank Aiken. Not as many people would have heard of his sister, Nano Aiken, but she was hugely significant.
Yeah, especially in the line of communication, carrying dispatches. So the Aikens' house was burned down during the War of Independence by the B Specials. And after that, she was pretty much on the run. She was well known by the authorities because she used to keep an arms dump in the house. And what she was doing was she was carrying arms for various attacks on the barracks, Camlough Barracks in South Armagh. And there was also another attack on the Newtown Hamilton Barracks. She carried all the weapons to the site, and then once it was carried out, the IRA men gave her the guns and she brought them back to the dump. Now, what's interesting about Nano is that she was initially in Cumann na mBan when it was founded in Armagh in 1918, but she was asked to leave, which is something that reoccurs all the time.
Why was she asked to leave?
She was asked to leave because She was known by the authorities, and if you were seen in a Cumann na mBan uniform, wearing a Cumann na mBan badge, you know, drilling down the street, you were going to be known. So by being on the run and following the IRA column, you were operating under the radar, basically. So, and of course, that makes it more difficult than when we come to pensions, applying for a pension.
Yeah, quite a number of women were either advised not to join Cumann na mBan if their activities were of real value to the IRA in terms of intelligence work, or to leave Cumann na mBan. In Cumann na mBan, they came to the attention of the authorities. If they're outside of it and they're not seen associating with Cumann na mBan members, then they can operate in greater secrecy. But again, it does impact on pensions. Who are they going to get to go as referees for them?
Because you need three referees.
The secrecy of what they were doing was so effective that nobody actually knew except those they were reporting to. So many women who actually contributed to the cause during this period were unable to get pensions subsequently.
Tomás, your work is focused on your home county of Clare. When did Cumann na mBan get up and running in Clare? Around the same time, 1914, 1915?
No, it was a little later, Miles. At a public level, it was 1917, and particularly during the by-election campaign for Eamon de Valera in July 1917, which was a big significant moment nationally for the Republican movement generally. But in terms of Cumann na mBan, it moved them from, you know, what had been a covert organisation to an overt organisation. And, you know, there's no question that they were somewhat active prior to that, because when you look at the level of organisation in July 1917, even though Cumann na mBan Cumanns were only established after that, you know, there was obviously an organisation in effect prior to that. So it's really at a public level for the people of County Clare during the by-election of Eamon de Valera and subsequent to that, in a period of, you know, unprecedented activity in County Clare, because you lead into the Mountjoy hunger strike and 16 Clare men are on that hunger strike out of 38 hunger strikers. So women in County Clare become incredibly active from July to September 1917 and are firmly embedded within the Republican movement at that point.
And I think you're talking about a period where World War One is continuing, and there were tensions between Cumann na mBan and some local women, the so-called the separation women, or in Cork they would have called it the separas.
Yeah, there was tension between the separation women and, I suppose, people who would have allied themselves with them and the broader Republican movement.
These are people
generally
whose husbands were fighting in
exactly.
World War I.
And I mean, it was manifest very violently during that election campaign, which is a very fraught and very violent campaign in general anyway. But there were numerous cases where Republicans, you know, both men and women, were attacked by separation women, where IRA volunteers had to form armed guards to protect voters, etc. So it was really violent, and there was tensions. There's also, you know, an example I found where a returned young British soldier was chased down the street of Innes by 30 Cumann na mBan women, I was told, were holding forks and pitchforks, etc. But certainly there were tensions. But the critical point in terms of the women's experiences, they're now publicly involved, you know, for the first time, where they had been privately involved prior to that. And I would make the point that, you know, that went generations back. I mean, during the evictions, during the land war, where Clare was particularly active, of course women had a role to play in that. And, you know, that was very much recognised at a local level. They were critically involved in all of the campaigns, because they have to be. And it is a point to be made at the broader experience. This is a functionalist sort of a movement, and if one element of it breaks down, then the whole thing breaks down. So the role of women in terms of the provision of information, of intelligence, of shelter, of care, you know, of arms, you know, is absolutely critical, because if that's not happening, then the guerrilla campaign breaks down. If safe houses aren't available, the guerrilla campaign breaks down. So it's really critical. And but in County Clare, we see it moving from 1917. We see it firmly embedded as a key part of that movement.
Now, your book, Time of the Tans, which was published earlier this year, draws on almost two decades of your own oral history, recordings and research to illustrate what was going on during the War of Independence in County Clare. And you brought in to us today one of those recordings, and this is of a man named Tom Brennan talking about his mother. Just give us a bit of context on Tom Brennan.
Sure, yeah. Well, Tom was recorded in Chicago. I arranged to have the recording take place because I had been on the telephone to Tom. I'd heard about him, made contact, and had been on the phone to him to speak to him about his connection to the revolutionary period. And, you know, it was significant in terms of being related to the Brennan brothers, etc. But when he spoke about his mother, the real key revelation came to me. And his mother, Elizabeth Brennan, was again a member of a Republican family, was tremendously active throughout the revolutionary period. But the revelation that Tom gives in the piece of audio, you know, which isn't the greatest piece of audio, but it's overcome by the quality of the material, is a really powerful revelation of the impact of women during that period.
OK, let's hear an extract from that 2010 recording of Tom Brennan.
There were six in the family, and I was the only one born in a nursing home. And this was because the black and tans raided my aunt's house where my mother was in bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was due to be born 3 days later. So they flashed the flashlight and she got a stroke or paralysis. She lost the power of all her left side. So I never saw my mother walk, but she could get around with the aid of a chair. And I was the only one, as I say, born in the nursing home. My brothers and sisters were all born in Six Mile Bridge.
And that was the voice there of Tom Brennan from the oral history collection of Tomás. A striking story. So traumatised by what happened that she had a stroke.
Yeah, you see a physical legacy there. I mean, it couldn't be more apparent. But you have to consider that's a woman who, you know, in the year and a half prior to that would have been cycling around, you know, East Clare and South East Clare, delivering dispatches, communications, helping with the movement of arms, you know, was at the centre of the revolutionary movement. And then, you know, falls pregnant and in the dying days of her pregnancy, this happens to her and she's left for the rest of her life. Now, the point I think needs to be made about that is it's very difficult to find, it's actually impossible to find that revelation, that story in any of the conventional records we have. So the narrative we have available to us at a public level about the women's experience doesn't tell us about that. And that's why I feel that the employment of oral history and memory at a local level opens up this world of experience that really reveals to us the true impact of that period on women. And not just members of Cumann na mBan. I think it's important to make the point that there are entire categories of experience outside of the official memberships of organisations. Young girls, old women, young men, old men, you know, who were directly involved in the various activities that are central to that movement, who will never be recognised in a conventional official record. And I think we have a body of work to do to expand our understanding of the overall period.
Mary, there was an infamous incident during the War of Independence involving the Black and Tans in Kerry, and that was at Knockinure. Mm-hmm. And your family has a connection to it. We'll talk about your own family's connection to it in a moment, but tell us what happened. Tell us about the murder of three young Kerry men at Knockinure on the 12th of May, 1921.
Well, three young men, all of them involved in the IRA with the North Kerry Flying Column, Welsh, Lyons and Dalton, were coming home from probably what had been an evening event in a local house, walking along the road, and a truck load of Black and Tans coming out from the stole came across them and basically took them into a field, lined them up. Well, there were four men. One man actually escaped.
Condé, it's Cornelius Day.
Yeah, and shot them. And so three of them were dead, all of them 19 to 21 years old. They took the bodies back to Ballymullen Barracks in Tralee. Where the Cumann na mBan come into this is the Ballydunahoo Cumann na mBan and other local Cumann na mBans were then dispatched to get the bodies, bring them back for burial. We have a report of some of those women going to the barracks in Listowel where they were mistreated. And interestingly, one of the stories I've heard of this is that they were told not to go up the side of the barracks with a Black and Tan because that's where they abuse women, and that's the term used, but to find a nice auxiliary officer to talk to. Anyway, they were told that the bodies were in Tralee. They went there and found them on top of a rick of turf, got them coffined and brought back to Listowel, where there was an absolute riot. And one of the women from the Ballydunahoo Cumann na mBan said, "I was treated brutally while trying to bring the men back." From there, then the three men were taken to their various parishes for burial, where they got both a religious and a Republican burial, all organised by Cumann na mBan. And I think this is part of the story that we often forget about the women of Cumann na mBan, you know, doing their militant activities. They were doing all of the caring activities, but they also had to bury so many people that were killed, including probably young men they knew, maybe young men they were, you know, involved with or interested in, their neighbours. They had to find their bloodied bodies, prepare them for burial, bring them back and organise the burial, including having the shots over their graves, usually with the Crown Forces surrounding the graveyard. And my own grandmother was involved in one of those burials.
Did she talk about it?
No, never.
She never talked about it?
She never talked about her involvement in Cumann na mBan. I only found out about that through stories in the family, not directly from her. But interestingly, recently I found a photograph online of the burial of Lyons. Lyons was from the village I grew up in, Duo, in Kerry. And there's a number of women at the graveside, including, I think, one of them is my grandmother. I have to get that verified. But yes, they took guns into the graveyard, secreted them in, brought them out, had the shots over the grave, and then brought them out again. And the story is the black and tans were outside the graveyard wall. So that sort of trauma history rarely makes it into the record. And you have to think of the psychological impact and the emotional impact of repeated brutality on the part of the black and tans and the Crown forces to these women as they're going about their business, but also the emotional impact of burying these young men, of caring for badly injured young men. And this history has to be part of what we look at in terms of Cumann na mBan as well, and their experiences and the legacies of that throughout their lives.
Let's talk a little bit more about the role of women in intelligence gathering. And Mary, initially at least, they were extremely valuable because I think, as you suggested, they were less likely to come under suspicion, or they were less likely to be searched by police.
That was initially the case, but I think certainly by 1921, the Crown forces were beginning to realise just how much covert work Cumann na mBan women were doing. And you find reports of female searchers, and even though I think there are some photos of female searchers travelling around with groups of black and tans and auxiliaries, one of whom we know was an English lady called Mary Sophia Allen, who was a pioneer of women's policing in England during the First World War. And we certainly know she spent time in Ireland as a female searcher with the Crown Forces. And again, some of the written record that we do have, like the bureau statements and the pensions from women themselves, refer specifically to being searched by women searchers.
Tell us a little bit about Mae Maguire, who I think is from Longford.
Mae Maguire was quite young at the time. I think in her pension statement, and I'm not sure if her pension statement is actually available yet, but I know there's a version of it in Sean McKeown's papers in UCD. And in that she talks about how she was only a short time out of school and had no trouble in getting around and contacting the IRA whenever there was work to be done. And very much the sense is the black and tans and the auxiliaries had no idea that this young slip of a girl, probably just possibly still in school from all they know, was doing such valuable covert work to undermine their activities. So I think she's a very good example of it. Another thing that strikes me about it is when she speaks about just being out of school is just how young some of these women were. We're talking about people who might have been 16, 17, 18, undertaking what, as Mary has said already, was extremely dangerous work. So I think that aspect of age and the youthfulness of this movement, and particularly how young some of these women were at the time, is a point to bear in mind as well.
And I think also in the case of Mae Maguire, that Sean McKeown had to intervene, or would have had to intervene, in order to ensure that she got credit for what she did.
Yes, and that point has been made. Mary, I think, and Alva have made that point very well. Women were very much the second-class citizen when it came to pensions anyway. Nano Aiken's brother didn't, when he was Minister for Defence, was none too keen on making sure that the women got their due deserts. He was quite dismissive of what women's chances would be. And his sidekick, John McCoy, who was very involved in assessing pensions, was also quite dismissive of the role of women. So there was a general sense that women's work was not on a par with that of men. But also, as Mary says, the nature of the women's work was almost unverifiable. So how could they show that they had done it? And you get the sense as well that the pensions were important for the women in some cases because of the small amount of money they could get. But it was the recognition. Having your certificate of military service and being able to wear your medal at the various commemorations and to have your pension, no matter how small it was in terms of financial reward, the importance of the recognition of getting that pension was huge for these women.
Ilva, sometimes women were asked to leave Cumann na mBan if they were going to be carrying out intelligence work. Isn't that the case?
Definitely, yeah. Often a lot of these women are sisters of the members of the IRA, and often they're asked to leave just because their work would be of more benefit under the radar of the RIC. It was often, you'll find it in the witness statements, men, local men, will refer to all sympathetic women as Cumann na mBan, even though they might never have been in Cumann na mBan, you know. So that makes it tricky to...
It can make it very confusing.
It can make it very confusing, definitely, because I think under the Cumann na mBan organisation, you needed 25 members to make up a branch, an affiliated branch. And like, for example, a little area in Louth, Smarmore, which is just outside RD, there's a woman called Mary French who was involved in Smarmore Cumann na mBan. And I've only ever located three members of Smarmore Cumann na mBan. She applies for a pension and Mary French says, oh, I was a member of Smarmore Cumann na mBan. But there was only three women in the branch. So they were acting as an auxiliary to the local Smarmore company of the IRA. So it is interesting, yeah. But and as we say, it makes it difficult to get pensions later on.
Mary, you talked there about the fact that after a certain period of time, the kind of the honeymoon period, if you like, for women who are working in intelligence or carrying dispatches or carrying weapons or what have you, is over. And they're now increasingly subject to search. But at what point did they become increasingly liable to be arrested and to be imprisoned?
That seems to date again, I'd say, probably the last 6 months of 1921. Going again on statements of people like, say, Margaret McGuinness from Longford, who was the niece of the Sinn Féin TD, Jo McGuinness, herself and her sisters. There were three sisters and also cousin Bridget Lyons. The three sisters lived in Longford and did the sort of thing Mary was talking about. Their uncle's shop was conveniently close to the barracks, so all they had to do was look out the window and keep an eye on the movement of Crown forces. But they would have been well known because of their links, and certainly in her pension statement, she refers to being arrested towards the end of the conflict in spring of 1921. So there's a much harsher line towards women in that last 6 months, which of course is the most intense period of the War of Independence as well.
And you've got some very prominent women who are arrested. I mean, Countess Markievicz being the best known, I suppose, but there were many others.
Yes, I think she was arrested towards the end. It was October 1920 when she was Minister for Labour, and then Joe McGrath had to step in as substitute minister, and then he was arrested as well. So the arrests had a big effect on the ability of the administrative aspect of the revolution to operate as well. So taking these prominent women out of the field did what it was intended to do.
Now, Mary, Cumann na mBan also, I think, were very much involved in something that was absolutely vital, or certainly Michael Collins would have thought it was vital, and that was the collection of the national loan, of Dáil-Éireann's national loan. Tell us about that work, if you would.
Yeah, well, Cumann na mBan were on the ground, were the ones who were able to continue collecting, fundraising. They were also very important, of course, in propaganda, but fundraising was very important because, of course, you needed funding to run the administration part of the alternative state, I suppose, and also to purchase arms and ammunition. Now, a lot of funds were coming in from Irish America, but also we needed to get it locally. And you see again and again women being picked up for collecting without a proper license or proper permission. So this begins to happen more and more through late 1920 and into 1921. Lil Conlon, for example, in writing about her experiences of Cumann na mBan and Cumann na mBan more broadly, she was a member in Cork, said that in late 1920 and into 21, a phrase which I think perfectly encapsulates it, that the going was rough on the female sex from that period onwards. Up to then, they'd kind of gone under the radar. They could do their fundraising, they could do their intelligence work, but they're beginning to be picked up more and more for all of this work. Now, most of them outside of the well-known women aren't held for very long, you know, a couple of days maybe, or even 24 hours. And interestingly, I was reading a report of the White Cross done by Meg Connery, a member of the Irish Women's Franchise League, and she does...
Just explain briefly what the White Cross was.
It was set up to aid those who were in need during this period. And she talks about the female searchers, but one incident where one woman was strip searched, all her clothes taken off, by a hooded figure, and that figure is not gendered. So the implication is it was a man dressed as a woman searching. So you wonder sometimes if this is being used as well on the women who were picked up.
Mary, also women played, whether they were members of Cumann na mBan or not, and many of them were, they played a huge role in propaganda activities. I mean, we all know about De Valera and Harry Boland to a more limited extent in the USA, but the McSweeneys, for example, they undertook a trip which was of major importance.
Yes, both the sister and widow of Terence McSweeney, his widow Muriel McSweeney and his sister Mary, very soon after Terence McSweeney's death, travelled to the US to give evidence to a body called the American Commission on Conditions in Ireland. And after that, Mary continued on, largely on a lecture tour throughout the US. I think Hannah Sheehy Skeffington went on lecture tours as well. And it's a whole aspect of women's work. And of course, people like Hannah Sheehy Skeffington and Muriel McSweeney as the widows of Irish men who had died in such tragic circumstances, largely at the hands of Crown forces, were very effective propaganda vehicles to have for the Republican campaign in the US. And again, maybe there's an element of conscious exploitation of gender there. You see the pictures of Muriel McSweeney during this trip and the widow's weeds and everything, and it's a very evocative photo, as is the evidence of both Muriel and Mary to the American Commission on Conditions in Ireland.
Who was Susanna Walsh? Because I think she gave evidence to the same commission, didn't she?
Yes, she was the sister-in-law of the other Lord Mayor of Cork who died in tragic circumstances, Tomás McCurtain. So again, the link there is of the two mayors of Cork dying in such tragic circumstances in such close succession. Those women travelling to the US and also getting around the so-called paper wall that the British were trying to put around Ireland to try and make sure these stories didn't get out. Once these women got to America and their evidence was reported, it reflected very badly on the British campaign in Ireland.
All right, we're going to take a quick break now, and when we return, we'll be hearing about the experience of Countess Markievicz and discussing the violence against women that took place during the war.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. Our theme this evening is women and the Irish War of Independence, and we've been talking about their role in intelligence and military support operations during the conflict, and also talking about the work of Cumann na mBan. Now, Countess Constance Markievicz is one of the most identifiable and iconic revolutionary figures of this period. She spent most of the War of Independence either behind bars or on the run. Colette Kinsella spoke to Lindy Nocton about the Countess's experience during the war.
There's an easy answer to the question of what Countess Markievicz was doing during the War of Independence. For most of it, she was in jail.
When it started in January of 1919, she was in Holloway Jail and she'd just been elected as an MP, the first one ever.
Markievicz was released in March that year, 1919. But instead of taking her Sinn Féin seat in the House of Commons, she joined the newly formed First Dáil in Dublin as Minister for Labour. This made her Europe's first ever female cabinet minister, although eventually this role would also make her an outlaw in the eyes of the British authorities. For the next few months, though, Markievicz worked hard on her brief.
She was running around the country to meetings all over the place. She was an absolute ball of energy, and she fed off people. She loved people and they loved her back.
That period of freedom, though, was a short one.
She was free from March to June,
which is when she was arrested for giving a so-called seditious speech.
She had given a talk supporting a boycott of the police, of the RIC, which was going on. She claimed that they accused her of trying to kill policemen and their babies, even worse. And she said, no. What we're trying to do is just ostracise them from their communities, because most of the RIC men were actually Irish Catholics.
On the 15th of June, Constance Markievicz was arrested and sentenced to 4 months imprisonment in Cork Jail. She'd always been known for the energy and enthusiasm she brought to everything she was involved in, including her work as Minister for Labour. But while in prison, even though she was physically absent from politics and family life, she wrote letters, hundreds of them, to stay connected with the people and the issues she was passionate about. And when Lindy Nocton started reading these letters, she discovered a different woman from the one portrayed in the press at the time.
In the early 1930s, the view of Markievicz was she was, as the British called her, a pestilential harridan. So there was this myth of her, of just a gunslinging lunatic, you know, which, let's face it, a lot of them were around that time, and we shouldn't forget that.
Markovitch wrote to friends, family and political colleagues. And the letters are insightful gems, like little tunnels into the mind of the writer. And she's very open about her views on women's rights and about being on the side of the less privileged.
She's saying exactly what we're saying now, that you can't have all the power concentrated in a small, limited number of people who are privileged.
In letters to her sister, she also focuses on the minutiae of domestic life, as well as literature and poetry. But one thing about these letters stands out. They're relentlessly upbeat, and it sounds like she's trying to shield her sister from the truth of her own predicament. Dearest old darling, Claire has just written that you were ill, and I am so sorry that I just got arrested, for I know how that will worry you. This is the most comfortable jail I've been in yet. There's a nice garden full of pinks, and you can hear the birds singing. I can't help laughing all the time. Anyhow, I'm all right, so don't you worry.
She definitely put a brave face on it. We have to remember at this stage she was also in her 50s. And even in the later on when she was jailed by the Irish Free State, she went on hunger strike for a couple of days, and all she says about it was, my rheumatism is quite gone.
Candice Markovitch was released from Cork prison in October 1919. By this time, the Dáil and Sinn Féin were prohibited by law. And for almost a year, while she continued her work as Minister for Labour, Markovitch was also on the run. She kept a stepladder outside her office window and sometimes disguised herself as a stooped old woman when she was travelling. In a letter to her sister Eva from this time, she makes jokes about how much fun she was having evading the police. Although she also writes, "It is rather wearying when the English manpack are in full cry after you." Despite all this, the letters indicate that her work was a priority, even if it wasn't quite as important to her colleagues.
She wasn't taken seriously. Michael Collins didn't take her seriously. But she carried on, and she was very respected as a negotiator. She could go into meetings, and she was smart. She was clever with people.
Constance Markovitch was arrested again in September 1920 and imprisoned in Mountjoy Jail. She was sentenced to 2 years hard labour and was released in July 1921, 10 days after a truce was declared in the War of Independence. In her letters from this time, Markovitch remained optimistic for the future, and she never lost her faith in the people of Ireland. "We suffer," she wrote, "and suffering teaches us to unite and stand by each other."
So the picture that comes across of her is a huge-hearted woman who you couldn't help but like.
Colette Kinsella was reporting there, and she was talking to Lindy Nocton about Countess Markovitch's experience during the Irish War of Independence. Lindy Nocton, of course, the author of two books on the Countess. Mary, did Markovitch tend to dominate? Certainly, in my view, she would have, as a student of history, dominate the narrative of Irish women and the War of Independence for a long, long time.
Well, I think Markovitch dominated the narrative of Irish women's revolutionary history from before the War of Independence for a very, very long time, for all sorts of reasons. She was an extraordinary character. She was definitely an outlier in terms of her class, her position in society, and just herself. You know, she was a woman who demanded attention in her personality and her activism. But you also have to pay tribute to her. I mean, she didn't get the credit for doing nothing. She did do all of the things that she is credited for in the history books. But I think her persona did dominate. And I think now we're beginning to see that Markovitch is in her proper place. Yes, being credited for being the amazing woman she was and all the things she did. And she suffered. I mean, she was in prison for at least six times between 1916 and 1923. Her health suffered. She died younger than she should have, I would argue, because of that. But because of the work of historians over the last 20, 30 years, we're beginning to see more women. The names are becoming more familiar now. The Kathleen Lynns, the Madeleine Finch-Mullins, the Ada English, Kate O'Callaghan, who was the widow of the Mayor of Limerick, who was killed as well, and many, many, many others, down to local Cumann na mBan branches. Regional histories are coming out. So I think Markovitch is in her deserved place, but it's no longer that dominant, all-encompassing the only woman.
She's no longer the Colossus.
She's no longer that Colossus. No. And I don't think she would have wanted to be. But I think she'd enjoy being important where she is, yes.
I think we can agree with that one. Now, we're going to turn to the subject of violence against women, which took a number of forms during the conflict. And it's important, Mary, I think, to note that both sides attacked women, and for different reasons.
Absolutely. During this conflict, again, coming back to that phrase by Lil Conan, the going was rough on the female sex for all sorts of reasons. And one of them was gendered and sexualized violence against women. The most commonly known would have been the hair cropping that occurred. And the argument is, was this sexual violence? I would say it is, because, you know, a woman is defined by her femininity, particularly in this time. Her hair is very much part of that. But also how hair cutting happened by both the IRA and the Crown Forces, often late at night, often dragging a young woman out of her bed in her nightclothes, isolating her either within the house or outside the house within a group. You know, there was always more than five armed and masked men. And in the reports on the hair cropping, often it is, you know, said that the woman suffered hair cropping and other indignities. And it is the language that is hard to unpack in many ways. What were these other indignities in addition to the hair cropping? And obviously, this may include sexual assault or indeed rape. The Crown Forces doing it, of course, to visit terror. Mm. This was part of their attacks.
Guilt by association.
Yeah,
as far as
on
concerned.
Communities and particularly IRA women. Like, many of them were beaten up. For example, Julia Duffy in Ballinlee in Longford had 9 teeth beaten out of her head in one particular incident. And then she says she continued her work. For women, for coming among women, getting their hair cropped wasn't as shaming as for women who were hair cropped by the IRA, who were, this happened for company keeping, under the suspicion that they might be informers. But also, I think there's a moral issue here. This is about making Irish women respectable, that they can't be, if you're going to be proper Irish women in the imagined Irish Republic, you have to behave in a proper moral fashion. And that doesn't include, you know, company keeping with RIC officers or auxiliaries or black and tans. Leo Buckley, in a member of the Limerick, of one of the Limerick branches of the IRA, talked about how the young girls had their heads turned by uniforms and that they had to be controlled. So it was all about power and control on the part of the IRA. So you have women's bodies being attacked by both groups. And I think we have to acknowledge that as well as part of our narratives of this period.
Mary, what have you found when you've researched something you call non-judicial repercussions for women?
Yes, I think what Mary is talking about there, definitely the hair cutting off was the most popular punishment meted out by both sides. And even listening to Mary's description of it there, it strikes me as, what did they cut the hair off with? I don't think they came with nice sharp barber scissors ready for it. It was probably often things like blunt, rusty old sheep shears that were used for shearing fleeces off sheep, which, to say the hair was cut off would be mild. It was probably hacked off. And even the depictions of it in things like Ryan's Daughter and the When the Chicks the Barley, I think, are kind of help us to visualise some of it. Other forms of violence, apart from the physical side of that, you can imagine the traumatic side of it. And there's a lot of psychological violence. Tomás McCurtain was mentioned there, as was Kate O'Callaghan. Both McCurtain's wife and O'Callaghan had to watch as their husbands were shot dead by the Crown Forces. And I think it was McCurtain's wife subsequently suffered a miscarriage. Kate O'Callaghan, in her bureau statement, talks about the indignity of her house being constantly raided and her clothes and her wardrobes and everything being rifled through. There's a lot of that. There's a lot of psychological terror behind it. But definitely the hair cutting on both sides is the most common form of violence in that period.
Physical violence? Serious physical violence?
Yes. We've things like the British Labour Party Commission, which visited Ireland, looked at attacks on the wives and barrack servants and people supplying goods to the RIC. And there was one lady who had pig rings inserted into her buttocks for dealing with the Crown Forces. Other forms of physical violence, assaults, physical assaults. The question Mary raised of sexual assault and rape is probably the hardest one to pin down. I have yet come across any example or any evidence of the IRA having raped anyone during the War of Independence. It is there from the Civil War. There's the example of Mrs. Biggs in Tipperary and a few other ones. I haven't yet found, maybe somebody else has found more of this, any evidence of the IRA carrying out sexual assaults on women during the War of Independence itself. As regards the Crown Forces, there's some evidence of it. There was an example of Kate Marin in Dundrum and Tipperary at the end of 1920. We know about her case because it was investigated as a death, but when you start to look into the details, it's quite clear that she was raped by soldiers prior, or certainly there was intercourse between herself and the soldiers, probably coerced before her death. So it's a very tricky one to find evidence of. I think the evidence, more evidence is coming available of it. We'll never know exactly how prevalent it was. My sense is that it still wasn't the most prevalent form of violence against women by either side during that conflict.
Mary, have you come across any evidence?
Yes, there's a Mrs. Healy in Cork who was raped. She was pregnant at the time, as far as I recall. Yes, but I would agree with Marie, there is very little obvious evidence of rapes in the War of Independence. You actually have a few more.
Is that something that women would have kept their own counsel
about? This is the problem, and this is why I think we have to be very mindful of the type of language used in the contemporary. Because Hannah Shee Skeffington, in her report to the American Commission that we've spoke about previously on conditions in Ireland, did talk about sexual assaults, although she mentioned one in Gort in County Galway that was still being investigated. There is no detail on that. Meg Connery, in her report to the White Cross, talked about how women knew that after curfew hours is when sexual assaults could occur. So their nerves were gone, she said, and they were very determined to stay in after curfew hours. And if they had any work to do, they had to make sure they weren't out then. So there is oral histories and there is written histories about a certain knowledge of the fact that this could occur, and maybe the psychological effect of it is as bad and indeed greater than what actually happened. Again, going around the country giving lectures on women in the War of Independence, I often get people telling me stories of how the women were very conscious of the fact that they could be sexually assaulted. But they're not going to report this to the authorities. Indeed, they're probably not going to report it to anybody. So where do we find the evidence? I think we can say that Ireland was exceptional in that it was a low rape war, but we can't say what happened either. So we're kind of caught in that bind of how do we find the evidence and how do we unpack that evidence. But I think we have to look at the language. The language used is outrage, indignity, insult. Force. I saw one piece of evidence there a few weeks ago where the woman talked about how a soldier tried to forcibly kiss her. And you wonder then, what is she saying here? So we have to question the evidence and look further and broader than maybe the mainstream archives, oral histories, memoirs, memories, and all of that. And I think as we go on, perhaps more will become clear.
Ilda, have you come across anything in County Louth in relation to violence?
Yeah,
perhaps sexual or physical violence, at least.
Yeah, there's two events that stick out. One is in Dundalk, and it's not explicit sexual violence, but there was a shop in Dundalk called Craig's Drapers. It was a Protestant employer, and during the War of Independence, the shop was burned down maliciously, and there were two women who were fatalities. One of them was Georgina Rice and the other was Elizabeth Wilson. And the IRA were implicated in the burning, but James McGuill, his witness statement to the Bureau, he was the commandant of the IRA in Dundalk, and he explicitly said no, the IRA weren't involved at all. And then the other event was in Dunlear in Mid-Louth. And it's funny that the whole incident, it fits the template of what Mary described as women's haircutting. Middle of the night, woman dragged out of bed. She was living with her brother. She was in her 30s and her hair was shorn. It was reported in the local newspapers and they didn't shy away from the fact at all that her hair was cut by masked intruders. And then later on that year in the Drogheda quarter sessions, she claimed £40 compensation for the trauma.
Thomas, what about County Clare? Many instances of violence against women there.
Yeah, there are examples, again, very similar to what we've been hearing there in terms of hair being cut to the bone in terms of language was one of the terms used, that hair was cut to the bone, again, by both the IRA and British forces as well. Probably more examples to be found within memory of the British forces cutting women's hair, you know, which I think has been said would connects you to the movement, connects you to the struggle, the suffering, which is in memory a key part of all of that. There was one example in Northclare, again, of a woman who had, similarly as Mary has mentioned, a pig ring inserted into her buttocks. Now, I think the point to be made in relation to that particular story is it was very much explicit that that woman had been, or at least it had been alleged, that she was giving information to the British forces. And that, I think, is a critical point, that violence, particularly Republican violence on women, or Republican violence on anybody, is correlated in most cases to information being provided to the British forces. And in the context of the conflict and the insurgency, that was an egregious act for the Republican movement looking on, because that could lead to somebody's death. So the violence is often, you know, explainable in that sense. In terms of British violence on women, there's numerous cases. I can't find, I've done hundreds of interviews, I haven't found any case of rape. I haven't found any case of rape from the Republican side. I'm willing to accept that it's certainly possible, and we have to look at the language, as Mary has said, to try and decipher, you know, the narrative. I would make one point in relation to morality and maybe looking on, you know, what Irish women should be doing. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think, again, certainly for active Republicans, the main issue of women talking to British forces was giving information. And that was the biggest grievance. And that was, in my evidence, in my research, the main reason why Republicans would inflict violence on women who were seen talking to British forces. It wasn't an issue of morality. Certainly during the conflict for Republicans, I'm sure there were people in society who would look on it in that way. But certainly for active Republicans, the key thing was, are you giving information to the British forces?
Interesting. I mean, Mary, we talked to you about, asked you about your grandmother who did not talk to you. Tomás, talking about the silence around women, did you find, because you, as you say, have done hundreds of interviews, that a lot of women were unwilling to talk about, women in particular, or more so perhaps than men, were unwilling to talk about what they had seen, what they had done, what they had experienced?
Yes, I thought it was interesting, though, when I was listening to Mary there, that I'm not sure if it's the case with Mary's grandmother, but in many cases they wouldn't talk to their own daughters or even their own granddaughters, but they may talk to somebody else. Mm. And that's the thing about memory generally, that it, you know, it bypasses the immediate family, but it can go elsewhere. And often I will talk to somebody whose mother or grandmother didn't mention anything to them, but the stories were disseminated elsewhere.
Tell us about Kathleen Foley, for example.
Yeah, well, it's just an example I was thinking of as you asked that question, because I was interviewing a lady in Ennis about 7 or 8 years ago, talking to her about her father, who was an active member of the Midclare IRA, Michael Foley, you know, spoke at length about that, and she was able to document from her knowledge what he had done. As always, I would inquire about the experience of women and Cumann na mBan. I asked, was her mother in Cumann na mBan? And she said, you know, she was, I think, involved in some way. She was involved in electioneering for De Valera, you know, but I don't think she was that active. But subsequent to the interview and our conversation, she mentioned that, you know, my mother had a box of documents that, you know, maybe 35 years ago I gave in to a cousin in Limerick, and I wonder what was in them. And naturally enough, I wondered too. So that night after I left, her son was ordered into Limerick to go to the cousin to find out, is the box still there? The cousin was ordered up to the attic where he retrieved the box of documents. It was brought back to Innes, and I was invited the following evening to go back to the house, which I did. I took away the box of documents. It took me 4 hours to copy them, to try and begin to figure them out. And those documents revealed that her mother, apart from being the shy, retiring, you know, woman who was involved in a bit of canvassing, was the second from the top in the East Clare Brigade of Cumann na mBan, was involved in all of the activities that we've chronicled here tonight. But it was only at the age of 91 that this woman in Innes found this revelation about her mother. So Kathleen Foley lived to an old age and lived with her daughter to an old age. But despite all those opportunities, the story of her revolutionary involvement wasn't disclosed until many years later.
Which brings us, I think, logically to the concluding question, Mary, and I'll put the same question to Mary as well. Were women written out of the narrative of the Irish War of Independence until now?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Yes, they were written out of the War of you have to look at it in a number of ways. Number one, what Cumann na mBan did demanded secrecy, because what they did was the intelligence work, really, the important part. So, and they continued with that secrecy afterwards. And I think the new state as well, the Irish Free State, was a bit of a cold house for political women, for women in Cumann na mBan, particularly after the Civil War. And also you have to think who was writing the history books. It was written from a very male-oriented perspective and also from a very national politics perspective. And of course, it's men who are very much involved in that and constructing the idea of the male heroic patriot in the early years of the Irish Free State. I think from the 70s and 80s, women are being rewritten back into the narrative. I mean, beginning with Margaret Ward's great work on Cumann na mBan and continuing on until today. But I think this decade of commemorations has been a great boon for women's history and for writing women back into this revolutionary period in all sorts of ways. The involvement of women in World War One, the separation women, the unionist women, the nationalist women, the feminist women, working class women involved in the Irish Women's Workers' Union and the Citizen Army. And people are fascinated by this. And I would imagine that everyone here has had the experience of talking about women around the country and people being absolutely engrossed and interested and engaged and then coming back with the stories. And the stories are coming out of the attics and the shoeboxes and people's memories. Because when you trigger that, they begin to talk and they begin to remember the stories they heard and they give you those details and then you can go away with them and go back into the archives and try and make sense of how they fit in to the narrative. So, yeah, women were written out, but they are fast coming back in.
I think it also helps that history is no longer such an utterly male-dominated profession as it was when it came to the 50th anniversary of these activities. Mary, you absolutely, I think you were very quick to agree with Mary there. In part, would this have been due to the fact that many of the prominent women of that period were anti-treaty?
It might have something to do with it, but they weren't all. And even the ones who are pro-treaty, yes, this did seem to take a back seat. But I think Mary's point is right. Who was writing the histories? And the first histories we have are the memoirs. You just have to look at the title of the four fighting stories, Dublin's, Cork's, Kerry's, Limerick's fighting story, and the subtitle, Told by the Men Who Made It. and or something like even F.X. Martin's work on leaders and men of the Easter Rising, even though there was a chapter on Markovitch. And I'd echo everything Mary is saying there. Margaret Ward's Unmanageable Revolutionaries really started to get things going. We have the archives now, but we've had, there are personal archives of Sheila Humphreys who started at the outset of the programme. There are now the Bureau, there's the pension files, of course. There's more material coming on stream from compensation files in the National Archives. There's the oral history that Tomás has done so much to gather up. But there is something about women did seem to be quite reticent about their activities as that story that Tomás has told us. Why, I'm not sure, but certainly there seems to be a partly deliberate effort to write them out of the narrative for quite a long time.
Tomás?
Yeah, I mean, I would absolutely agree with both Mary and Mary. Obviously, I think we have a job of work, as I mentioned earlier, to expand our understanding of the overall period. And we sometimes, are in danger of again, hierarchizing even women. And, you know, most of the women we've mentioned here tonight were at the more senior level of Cumann na mBan. And there are such a world of experience in terms of women's involvement well beneath that seniority. So we have to really try and expand it, I think. There is a point to be made in relation to being written out of history is what history, though, because and what is history? You know, how was historical consciousness formed? And it's something I've thought about a lot. I would have said those words, women are written out of history. And I completely agree that they have not gotten the recognition that they deserve. But when I go down to the level of the local and I speak to people about their historical understanding, women come up. They're there. You have to trigger it sometimes, as Mary says, in lectures, etc. People will come forward with the stories. But they're there. They're writ large in the historical memory of local communities. So in terms of forming historical consciousness, if we're basing that on, you know, the very limited academic output up until the 60s or 70s, the biographies which were written by men about men in many cases, that doesn't represent the full nature of historical understanding. But I also think as well, to make the point, you know, again, we have to go down to the level beneath membership, you know, in terms of experience of women. And also, you know, men who were not included in that narrative. There's a hierarchy in all things, but in terms of IRA activity and recognition of that, it starts at the top and very few of them at the lower level. Margaret Keogh was shot dead by British forces on the 10th of July 1921 in Ringsend. On the same day, between Feagle and Bodeik in East Clare, a 41-year-old man was shot dead by the Oxford of Buckinghamshire Regiment. His name was Jim Grogan. He doesn't appear at a public level as one of the key figures in Clare, so he's forgotten as well. And I think we have to break apart that hierarchy to try and bring about an understanding of an experience that hit every home across the country in many ways. 48,374 homes are raided across 1920 in Ireland. And in all of those raids, you can be full sure that older women, young women, older men, young men, suffered as a consequence of that. And unless we find a way of telling that full story, then all women will be continue to be written out, or certainly an awful lot of them.
Ilva, last word to you.
Yeah, and I think in the aftermath, and certainly due to the conservative nature of Irish society in after the formation of the Free State, I think women, they had a habit of downplaying and underestimating their own involvement and their own importance in the organisation. Like, so many times I've heard women in interviews saying, oh sure, I only carried a few guns, I didn't really do anything, you know, like, and you're screaming at them to try and get the actual details. And I think where you see that the most is in the pension applications. You know, it was a very detailed form, it was 19 pages long or something like that, and there wasn't an awful lot of space to document your activities. And I think at the time as well, women weren't used to form filling, you know, they weren't used to talking about their activities. So they only write a few words in their application. And then it's when their application is rejected that it all comes out and you say, well, actually, this is what I really did. And just to mention as well on Tomás's point about the county series and how important local history is to the decade of centenaries, you know, it's when we were talking about Countess Markovic, the approach to history was very much from a top down, but now it's becoming more of a bottom up. And I think the Four Courts county series has done absolutely phenomenal work in highlighting all these stories. So long may it continue.
That's just about all we have time for this evening's programme. My thanks to all our guests, to Mary Coleman in Belfast, to Mary McAuliffe, Tomás McNamara, and to Ilva Rogers. And thanks also to the archivists in the Military Archives for their assistance with this programme. Our researcher is Liz Gillis. On sound tonight was Brian E. October. Join us at the same time next week when we continue our series on the War of Independence. You can find podcasts of all our episodes on our website, rte.ie/history. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.